Tony Gosling then, great writer, great broadcaster, attended the Bilderberg conference. He didn't attend himself, Tony. He didn't have an invitation. He wasn't sitting there hobnobbing it with the bad and the even badder and Henry Kissinger. But he did go there. He's been going there for many years. He's a great pal and a leading authority on all things Bilderberg. Good evening, Tony.
Good evening, Richie. I always encourage people to come to these conferences, particularly since you kind of bump into, as I did, Mark Carney in the street. Yeah. And, you know, this is the place where these people kind of hang out. And they're actually very good at sort of getting out of the conference. And they, for example, on Saturday, they decided they were going to go for dinner somewhere nearby at a museum. So, you know, there is very much an opportunity to actually speak to these people, to put questions to them. You know, they don't really want to answer as soon as they realize that you're either filming them or recording them in some way. But, I mean, you're up close and personal to some of the most powerful people in the Western world, and particularly the people who are financing the future. That's really what we're talking about.
You did a great job of explaining what it is when we spoke on Thursday. You, after all of these years, you still retain a real sense of indignation, don't you, at the cheek of these people to go about doing what it is they do, these unelected people treating the rest of us like we're pawns on a chessboard, effectively, Tony.
Well, it's partly because there's so many elected people in there as well. I mean, yeah. I think this year we're talking about 15 elected politicians from the European countries, plus another 6 from the unelected EU Commission. So that's what I find so irritating about it, is that you've got all these elected people basically getting their marching orders from the banksters. And if you look at look around the world and you see what's coming through as policy these days, then it's obvious. I mean, I think for me, one of the most interesting examples is this guy David Lammy, who's been here this weekend. He was also at last year's Bilderberg. He's one of those individuals that he's a Labour MP, and he seems to want to bend over backwards to do everything he can to just be the kind of person that the rich and powerful want in order to get ahead in politics. And so he's a sort of Macbeth-style ambitious maniac, effectively, that he will do almost anything in order to be. He's just a willing lackey of this lot. And I think every time now I see David Lammy, particularly after the last year's Bilderberg, I just see somebody who is a sort of archetypal toady politician who's got no principles, no real beliefs, but he just wants to shapeshift into whichever personality the elite and powerful puppeteers want.
Yeah, he's got a radio show on LBC, which is insane. What are there specific examples in very recent years of things that Lammy is supporting or doing that would lead you to conclude that he's such a lackey for the Bilderberg?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, the main one is Ukraine. Secondly, he's absolutely up for all the jabs. He's been completely 100% behind all that. Completely into the whole LGBT education of young kids, which has left Britain in the insane position of now having 20% of our young people aren't quite sure what sex they are.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get any of that in Portugal, really, I think it's fair to say. You look at the Portuguese youngsters, they look really well adjusted, they look happy. You know, they look like they can express themselves without any kind of fear of anything. In fact, we were in a monastery today, and some of the kids that were on a tour from the local schools then put on a play, you know, in front of it, and they looked so happy. They just looked like they could basically do whatever they want, and there was no pressure on them to take on any bizarre weird beliefs. And it's that sort of place. It's the Portuguese people are just gentle, soft, almost like, you know, I suppose the Brits used to be many years ago, maybe not in the East End of London, but, you know, their moral attitude to everybody else is always a presumption presumption of innocence and a presumption of friendship. Whereas we've been slowly groomed over the last 40 or 50 years in Britain to be suspicious of people. You know, so the idea is that human nature is, you know, is dark and potentially people are going to be predatory. Here, it's not like that at all. It's obviously it's a Mediterranean Catholic country, and it's so different to the UK. You know, it's really good, I think, to look. To take these trips away, just to realise how dark, actually, you know, particularly with the kids' education, Britain's becoming, Richie.
Yeah, we could do a whole show on that. We might do a whole show on it. Can I just bring
Say one thing about Lammy first, because I don't think this had happened on Thursday when I spoke to you, and stop me if it had, but we had an amazing incident with him when he turned up, I think it was on Friday. David Lammy, they wouldn't let him in.
They declined to admit him, did they? Go on.
They wouldn't let him in.
Why?
I mean, we had a very similar thing actually in Dresden. Well, I think it was Dresden with Ed Balls, and it's horribly embarrassing when you get someone who thinks they're important. You're looking at me, you're thinking you're not important enough, mate. You know, and so they wouldn't. No. He had to get out the car. In fact, he I think he came in a cab. Yeah, he came in a cab. And he was stood around, and everyone was click, 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 taking pictures of him, and in the outer level of security just wouldn't let him through. And so rather than just wait, as most of them do, for a couple of minutes for someone to come out and clear him and get in, he ran off with his bag and hid behind a bush. And he didn't want to be photographed. So, of course, you know, various people are going off behind the bush, taking pictures of him behind the bush. And he was trying to hide further behind the bush. And it was just, you know, a ridiculous kind of farcical Monty Python style situation. So by which point the Bilderberg security people were there saying, you know, where is he? You know, we've heard that Lammy's arrived and we want to make sure he can talk.
Yeah.
Where's he gone? And they were asking the photographers, well, do you know where he's gone? You know, like, and so yes, Italian Belgian guy Giorgio took him out, took the security, said, come over here, and he's just in there behind that bush hiding. Yeah,
they are ridiculous people. The Guardian.
So that's Lammy for you. You know, he's not only is he a lackey, but he's also a coward. In fact, he doesn't want to be photographed. So, of course, those pictures are hopefully going to be all over the place. There's been only a few mainstream press articles in the UK. The ones I've seen, Guardian, Charlie Skell's done an excellent job in just ripping them to shreds, as they should be, of course, lampooning the Bilderbergers and Henry Kissinger particularly. The Mail did a reasonable piece, but virtually nothing else, Richie.
I did read an interesting article in The Guardian today. British arms exports doubled last year to a record £8.5 billion. Now, Bilderberg happened this weekend. You were there. This morning, the Biden administration has pushed F-16s for Ukraine. The Russian ambassador to the United States has laughed at that and said there aren't any Ukrainian pilots to fly them. There isn't the infrastructure in Ukraine for these things to take off in any case. But I wonder, that announcement from the Biden administration, is that something that likely came out of Bilderberg over the weekend? Let's push hard for more arms for Ukraine.
Well, it's possible. I mean, there's been pressure for a long time through all these organisations, including the G7, to do this kind of thing. And we did have the Ukrainian foreign minister in here with these NATO chiefs. I mean, I think Britain has sort of found its mojo now, hasn't it, with the Ukraine war. Hey, look, we've doubled our arms sales. We've found an export market that we can actually make some money at, because there's nothing else. I mean, nothing. Is there? One thing is Britain producing that they can export? No, but they can export weapons and they can export death and war.
Yeah.
We can. I mean, whether that's a decision which was actually made in here, I doubt it, because although, of course, it is a very good place for prime ministers to make off-the-record deals with a specific individual. I mean, we have three prime ministers here. We had the Dutch, the Danish, and another one, I can't remember which now, in Europe. And then there was a deputy prime minister of Canada. There's a whole load of politicians. And that's what is really makes the entire thing stink. Charlie said, and he's quite right in his article, it's like a council of war. So the idea is there's a horrible atmosphere, I think, for many of the participants when they're turning up, particularly the arty types, that they're being brought into sort of sugarcoat what is effectively a kind of press gang situation where they're trying to get various politicians to get their policy behind this insane war in Ukraine, which Ukraine can never win. The more they keep talking about them winning, the more Ukrainians are dying. Over the weekend, I bet that wasn't even mentioned inside the Bilderberg meeting, was the fall of Bakhmut, finally, with a Russian private military company actually taking on the state army of Ukraine and winning. I think that's probably the first time in history that's happened, but that's not being talked about in there. So, I think important for me, I've been doing this for a few years, is, I mean, okay, so it's about Ukraine. A lot of what's going on in there is about trying to get all these politicians behind the war in Ukraine. And many of them, are, I mean, the Portuguese, for example, are not enthusiastic behind it. I mean, I was chatting to some police here, actually, the other day, and saying, well, would you like to sign up to fight the Russians? And there were three of them all at once. No.
Yeah.
So, of course, nobody wants this. And yet they're trying to shoehorn everybody into it. But it's, I think, part of a much bigger... Bilderberg is part of a much bigger movement, which is this accelerationist movement towards creating crises that you then make worse. So in COVID we had, obviously, and the vaccines, so-called vaccines, the jabs, making things worse by actually making probably more people sick than COVID did, and increasing these long-term health effects through autoimmune disease, people getting in later life and dying prematurely because they've had these mRNA or the adenovirus, you know, the AstraZeneca jabs, the blood clots, and you know, all sorts of horrific stuff like that, people being conned into it through propaganda. So, you know, there's that, there's the migrant crisis, the economic crisis. I mean, there's all these crises. I can't quite believe that you've got for example, you've got the British government and the US government now quite straight-faced saying, oh, we're going to have to increase interest rates to keep inflation down. Well, interest rates don't keep inflation down. They raise inflation. You know, so what we've got is this acceleration. That's what accelerationism is you come up with and you spin for the public a whole bunch of solutions to various different problems, which are actually going to exacerbate the problems rather than make them any better. And that, I think, is, I mean, of course, the mainstream press is absolutely culpable in all that. So, you know, it's why it's so important shows like yours, Richie, and mine, I suppose, where we're plugging away with an element of something that has the ring of truth about it. So things aren't quite right, are they? And this is why. And Bilderberg, you know, with all the bankers particularly, but all the oil company. I realised there's another oil company in there I didn't even realise, because one of the participants is a director of Chevron, and it's not written on the list. So you have to kind of go through the list and look up each name on the internet to find out what their other directorships are that they're not talking about. They're one of them that we had, I think, altogether five directors of world's major oil companies sitting in there with all these politicians. And of course, they're the people who are driving the policy now. I mean, the 70 odd billion annual profits from oil. These are the most powerful rich people in the world, and the politicians have got nothing to say, Richie, about these. And, you know, they are calling the shots.
And those who are unfamiliar with Bilderberg should take note that they never, ever, ever release the minutes of these meetings. Tony Gosling is our guest. I want to get through two or three more things before the top of the hour, mate. But on the Ukraine, on the situation in Ukraine, it looks to me like what is desired there is that this gets mired and it goes on for ages. Because the longer this goes on, the more it can be used to justify anything, really, any secondary or tertiary crisis. You know, well, we have another crisis, but it's because of the situation in Ukraine. Do you see that this Ukraine, this is not going to end anytime soon, and we could be looking at years just before we talk about one or two other things?
Yes, I think you're right. And Mark Sloboda came on our program. He's right when it all started, nuclear engineer of some sort. I think he was an army officer that was in charge of something to do with the nuclear launch sites. And he's now teaching at Moscow State University. He was absolutely adamant to right at the start, no, this is never going to finish, because the Russians have realized that actually a lot of these peripheral wars that we've had over the last 30, 40 years have really been tinkering around the edges, and that really what the Americans really want to take on are the Russians. And now the Russians have engaged with the Yanks via Ukraine, And the Brits, obviously, cheerleading on in a sort of pathetic little way. Is going to be an end game. This is either one or the other is going to go. Means really you're either going to have to get a US president who is going to stop it, which is highly unlikely, or else, you know, that one side or the other is going to win through an exchange. But the thing is, the Americans know that they can pour more and more and more into this because they've got all of Europe, you know, hundreds of millions of people in Europe as a kind of buffer between them and the Russians. So they've somehow managed to convince the Europeans through the EU, mainly, and Ursula von der Leyen, who again was groomed at Bilderberg and, you know, put in place by Kissinger via Bilderberg. In fact, she was sitting at the head table with Henry Kissinger back in Dresden in 2016, I remember. And so she's really just the person that gets the orders from the States to get Europe to swivel whichever way the Yankees want.
Tell me this, the BBC, your old parish, has launched a 60-strong team of journalists to work on something called BBC Verify, where we are told, and I wanted to ask you this, we are told that the BBC will take you behind the scenes to show you why it should be the most trusted source of news, why when it tells you something, you can take it to the bank. Let me ask you this. Is that in some way related, this launch of BBC Verify, to the online safety bill going through the House of Lords at the moment? Because I think it just might be. What do you think?
I think it's probably more related to the fact that the BBC's ratings are plummeting and that people don't trust it anymore. So someone at the board is saying, well, people don't trust us. Well, we need to tell people why they must trust us. Now, that isn't going to work, but it makes the senior producers and the controllers of the various channels feel better about the lies that they've been telling themselves about how good they are. I mean, I don't know if you saw the figures at the end of beginning of last week for talk TV and talk radio. Very, very good figures. The BBC's Today programmes lost a massive amount in the last year of their audience. Hundreds of thousands of listeners have just fled because it's badly produced, it's propaganda, and people don't know, have a kind of sixth sense about when stuff's nonsense and rubbish, and they might be convinced to keep watching it for a while, but after a while they just switch off and listen to something else. In this case, it's Rupert Murdoch's talk TV, talk radio.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, T? That's a problem, though, isn't it? I mean, so we understand why they abandon the BBC Radio 4 Today programme. We understand why they get fed up of Naga Monchetti, of course, because it is propagandistic bollocks, not to put too fine a point on it. But then they end up going to echo chambers like Talk TV and GB News, and that's all they are, is echo chambers, right?
Well, no, they're a bit more than that. I think the fact that Talk TV has a very open, pretty much anybody can just pick up a phone and get on there and talk. So it's, I'm not really so much not concerned me. About the presenters, but, you know, it seems to be pretty, I seem to be able to manage to get on there fairly easily. And that's because they've been trying to build up an audience, and they have built up an audience. It may be now they've got these figures through, they start restricting who can come on, and they start, you know, because obviously they keep logs of people, everyone that phones in. And so if you phone in another time, they've got a black mark next to your name. Well, you know, obviously the BBC, I think almost certainly have been doing that for a long time. But then maybe it's just a form of self-censorship. So I just think the decision at the Beeb to spend so much time on so-called verifying that they're telling the truth when they're lying is just a symptomatic of their, it's a sort of psychopathic insanity, really, that they think that they can tell everyone else what to think, and they don't have any kind of checks and balances on their own. You know, they don't allow criticism of themselves, and these are the sort of sycophantic people, imagine, you know, that Orwell talked about in much of his literature, who just simply want to pat themselves and pat each other on the back. I mean, we knew them as the media lovies, the ones that when you do a program will come over and say, oh, it's such a great program, you know, look, just F off, will you? You know, that's not what I want to hear. What I want to hear is criticism, you know, something that didn't work, you know, whatever, that's fine. Let's talk that through. But I think this is what's going on in many people's heads is their inability to be self-critical. And that is actually translated into an entire kind of worldview at the BBC with these kind of cowards and control freaks running it. And that's why every week when I do my show, I say, thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, because that's what I see the radio and the television as now. I really feel, I listen to it and I think this is a psychopathic nonsense that's coming out of this thing, and it's poison. You know, it's like, I mean, the thing is, the broadcast media, particularly, and includes the newspapers, is really the nervous system of humanity. So this is how humanity kind of talks to itself and, you know, makes things move and whatever. And what the mainstream press now is, you know, it's, whether it's BBC or whether it's private equity controlled and run, is poison. It's like sarin nerve gas, you know, it's going through the nerves. You know, that stuff that the BBC said was happening in Syria, which wasn't, you know. And and that's the problem, is you've got a poison going through that system, which the people who are running it just don't dare acknowledge. It's a bit like, you know, they don't dare mention Diana down at Highgrove, you know, around King Charles, because you say the word and that's it, you're being instantly sacked.
You're gone.
And by the way, there have been quite a few deaths of employees at Highgrove over the last ten years or so. People falling down wells and things like that.
That's another story for another day. Before we talk about Jimmy Savile, funny you mentioned getting on to other programs. I was out running, about 6 or 8 weeks ago. And funny about this ringing up, and completely subconsciously, and I mean this, I was running and Nicky Campbell was on there and he was talking about capital. He was talking about capital punishment because Lee Anderson, the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, was talking a load of tosh about capital punishment. So without even thinking about it, to my shame, I texted in, you know, that I spent some time, quite a bit of time in my youth, writing to condemned men in American prisons. And, you know, blah, 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 the conditions and one thing and another. Very quick text anyway. They came back to me within minutes to ask me to go on the air. And I thought, because I just said, Rick, right? Blah, 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 writing to death row prisoners, Rick. And they came back to me. And I thought about going on and then just calling Campbell out for his, you know, behaviour over COVID. And then It would have been fun. But then I thought, that's a bit cheap, that. And it's the sort of thing that we would criticise them for doing. You know, that kind of gotcha nonsense. So I thought, no. So when they said to me, because they rang me and said, will you come on? I said, I was about to. And I thought, no, I won't. I'll have another opportunity in the future, and I'll deal with more.
Well, it's good that they called you. I mean, it shows you they're desperate for callers. For new people, maybe I should try as well.
Yeah, do that too. Now, come here, Jimmy Savile. Holy, the two things before we say Jimmy Savile. What do you make of the news that a reservoir, is it in Portugal where you've just come from, or is it in Germany? It's in Germany, is it? They're going to troll a reservoir for the remains of Madeleine McCann. Why won't the police give up on Madeleine McCann, Tony, quickly, before we talk Savile?
Well, I think it's right that the police should, you know, the Portuguese, isn't it, police that should keep going on that. Because I can remember at the time reading about, I think it was an article in The Guardian, the Casa Pia paedophile ring, which was a scandal that had been going on in the years before the disappearance, and it hadn't come to any proper conclusion. It was a cover-up, very much like our VIP defile cover-up. And, you know, so for me, that's where the Portuguese police should have been focusing. And exactly like Savile, they never did. You know, the fact is that the police, as soon as they start getting very close to criminals at the very top of society, they just get either scared off, they'll get warned off, or they will get ordered off. So that's the way it works. And I think that's why the only kind of inkling we ever get that these sorts of things are going on, you know, with senior politicians, judges, etc., being caught up in these paedophile rings, or else just being paedophiles themselves. I mean, sometimes it's entrapment, sometimes it's just a proclivity for that sort of disgusting behaviour. And so I think that's why the Portuguese police shouldn't give up. You know, in a similar way that the police shouldn't give up on any of these kind of any unsolved, you know, murder cases, serious criminal cases, and particularly when it comes to investigating the rich and powerful.
Good stuff. Tony Gosling is our guest. Thisweek.org.uk, terrific website. Brilliant radio programme every Friday at 5 o'clock out of Bristol. You'll hear Martin on there. You'll hear excellent guests and stuff. Come here and I tell you, let's do, what's going on with Jimmy Savile then? You've, I didn't see this at all, but you uncovered this. He could have been caught many times.
Okay, so we all know about the police prosecutions of Savile in the 1990s, which were quashed by Starmer. Now, Boris Johnson dared to mention this a couple of years ago in the Houses of Parliament, didn't he? And then he was the press turned on him for that. That's a terrible thing to do because, of course, the establishment has decided that Keir Starmer is going to be the next Prime Minister. So we can't allow the truth about how he is, whether it's prosecuted an innocent Julian Assange or else let, I mean, this is his real big Achilles heel that he let off twice. He quashed prosecutions by Surrey Police in the 1990s of Jimmy Savile when he was Director of Public Prosecutions. You know, this way of corrupting public prosecutors, which Keir Starmer was, is the mafia's chosen method to control a country. So they did exactly the same over in Ukraine, didn't they? With Hunter Biden, when the Ukrainian prosecutor wanted to pursue criminal charges against him, and then Joe Biden turns up and says, "Oh well, if you want this loan." An IMF loan, I think it was. If you want this loan, then you're going to have to just change the prosecutor because we've decided we don't like this guy. And so within a few hours, the prosecutor had been sacked in Ukraine. So this position that Starmer had is absolutely key to whether or not you have a rule of law in your country. And clearly under Starmer, and particularly with the Savile case and the Assange cases, we didn't have a rule of law under Starmer, so he should have been, you know, it's easy to say this, but the guy should have been not lynched, but put in jail for that, or tried for corruption, perverting the course of justice, I think it's called, which is up to life in prison. So Starmer should not be standing to be the next Prime Minister, he should be in jail. So this new information that I got a couple of weeks ago is from a journalistic colleague up in Coventry, lovely guy as well, Chris Hewitt. He's been a journalist for around about 50 years now, and he's still doing a bit of freelance work. He does a lot on technology, computing and this sort of thing, latest developments, and he's very good on computer security, that kind of stuff. But he's when he was working on the Coventry Telegraph back in the 1970s, he was chatting to the vice squad at West Midlands, who categorically told him, well, Savile, you know, every time we've arrested him, that wasn't just the West Midlands police, that was forces all over the country. This is in 1978. Savile had already been arrested six times or more, and then released, and the charges dropped under the orders of MI5, Special Branch. So his conclusion, Chris's conclusion, quite reasonably, was that he was some sort of MI5 informant that was working at the BBC and wherever else, but he was there to keep a close eye on everybody and feed information back to the security services. But that certainly, you know, doesn't give him the excuse to go around. And of course, nothing was done about it. So you would have thought, you know, if in any kind of normal world, the security services would have had a word with Savile and said, look, you've been arrested for this, and we can help, you know, we've let, you know, help get you off, but you know, you've got to stop behaving like that. But no, he carried on behaving as a serial paedophile with the protection of MI5, Richie, right from the 1970s all the way through. But it's just really, I think, really important to get these specific examples of the way that it wasn't just a phenomenon that was you know, going on behind closed doors, and there was attempts to prosecute Savile in the 90s. No, it was going on way, way, way before that. And everybody, including Chris, told me, the record producer, Pete Waterman, who, I mean, he was actually very good. He did Bananarama, all these kinds of people in the 80s, etc. And that he said, yes, the guy's a paedophile. Just make sure you keep him away. Because Chris told me they were thinking about booking Savile for some event. And they said, well, how old are the girls? And only if they're in their 20s is it safe. Because any, you know, girls, particularly underage girls, Savile will just basically drag them off and potentially rape them. So you mustn't have, you know, have him come to an event to do that. But this is what I found so interesting was it's right, you know, it goes right way back into the 70s. And what is MI5? This is an organization which is run, it's not just by itself, it's part of the royal establishment. So it's, you know, like MI6, it's partly Ministry of Defence, Foreign Office, the MI6 is, and the MI5 is Home Office. But it's also works very closely with the Crown. So this is, we're talking about at the time the Queen, Prince Charles, would almost certainly have known about Savile. This is way back into the 1970s. In fact, I think it's impossible to say they didn't know about it. Because if something like this is going on, where someone's being protected who's a paedophile, then the officers, etc., who are protecting them would have to know that what they were doing had the approval of the royal family. So that's why I think this is such an important indictment of the British royal family, particularly our now present King Charles and his friendship with Savile, because he will have known right the way from the 1970s that he had these tendencies to rape young girls and as a paedophile. And this is one of the things I think is so concerning about Charlie.
But you could, hang on a second, you could also make an argument that even the future king would be in a need to know position that maybe you could make an argument that they withheld this information from him. I mean, he wasn't with Savile when Savile was raping children and, you know, going into the hospital and doing these unspeakable things. And if the security services knew, and I think you're bang on the money, of course they knew, we know that now, you know, you could make the argument that maybe they would have kept this information from Charles for his own good.
Yeah, but I'm afraid it doesn't wash, because the way it works, because the actual individual royals are actually at the top of these services, what happens is if you don't tell them and the truth then comes out and they didn't approve, you're for the high jump. That's the way these things work. You have to make sure that that there is some awareness of your bosses about what's going on. And it's only if your bosses then give you the nod and the wink that you can carry on. Because if those boss, if your Charles or the Queen, I've no idea who would have been in charge of this, but certainly one or the other would have been. And Charles, by the way, now is in charge of all of the secret services. He's the honorary chief of GCHQ, MI6 and MI5, and he has formally made that position absolutely 100% transparently clear.
Well, hang on. T, prove that to somebody who's listening to this who says, ah, come on, Tony, that's a load of bollocks. He's got nothing to do with MI5. We'd know he'd be on the letterhead, or we would hear about it. It would be mentioned that he has a say. I mean, MI5 has a chief. I don't know who it is at the moment. And that's who calls the shots at MI5.
Well, where's the proof that Charles is doing? That's the argument Chris Hewitt used to me. Yeah. And I don't buy it, because I know the situation is, if you're an officer under orders and you see something that's going on that shouldn't be going on, you need to check that with somebody above to make sure that it does have approval from the top. Because if you get discovered to have been doing something criminal in the army without the approval of people above you, then you're in serious doo-doos. And you may well be, you know, literally the next day hung out to dry. So there's only one way that can have been going on, and that's with the approval of the higher-ups, Richie. That's what I believe.
Yeah, and you might very well be right. That's pretty much it for today, mate. Thanks again for Thursday for today. Thanks for the work you've done. I'm sure that that more people over the years know about the existence of these secret societies because of the work you've done, and I'm pretty proud of that. So well done, pal. Thisweek.org.uk.
Well, I think also with the Bilderbergs, they're all part of this plot to cancel God. You know, so there is this kind of general feel out there that, oh, this is all very old-fashioned, this silly God stuff. Actually, it's rather important that we've got a morality, because as soon as you start saying, oh, it's a secular world, we're going to, you know, just get rid of all this God stuff from our schools, from everywhere else, you know, no religious education. Well, what that means is people are getting educated in something else, whether it's, you know, money, whether it's all that we're all selfish. And I think this is one of the things that's changed the character of society. Think about Google and the way that that's affected our relationships. Rather than chit chat to people in a foreign country like I'm in at the moment, you tend to look it up on your phone. You're not trying to communicate individually. You're now going through Eric Schmidt. And that's why he's one of the most powerful people who's been here this weekend at the Bilderberg meeting. And I'd just like to plug my book, by the way, which links the Bilderbergs absolutely with the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem. And what I think I've absolutely proved there is that Bilderberg actually is a Fourth Reich Nazi operation. And that's why I keep following them and I keep my eye on them. Because I think that's the long and short of it is that we're now dealing with the aftermath of World War II still.
Great work, T. The Traitors of Arnhem is a terrific read, folks. Tony, thanks very much. Good to have you back on, pal. We'll speak real soon. Thank you very much again. Tony Gosling, not the BCFM politics show, live this Friday from Bristol at 5 o'clock. Don't miss it. Brilliant stuff. Thank you again, Tony.